The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia Online. My name is Jason Freeman, and I'm excited to be here to introduce tonight's guest, Rebecca Rukeyser. Praised by Carmen Maria Machado as a, quote, sharp, flawless, sexy, and dark, and strange, and absolutely perfect, many of my favorite words, debut novel, Rebecca Rukeyser's The Seaplane on Final Approach follows the increasingly elaborate erotic desires of a young woman working on a remote and chaotic Alaskan tourist island. I'm sold already. Time has named it a best book of summer 22. A professor of fiction writing at Bard College Berlin and the recipient of the inaugural Berlin Senate Endowment for Non-German Literature, Rebecca has published stories in a variety of publications, including the Massachusetts Review and the Best American Non-Required Reading. She earned an MFA from the Iowa Writers' Workshop, and prior to moving to Germany, she lived and worked in South Korea, Japan, Turkey, and China. I'd also like to point out that the publication date of Seaplane on Final Approach was just 2 days ago, so we're especially lucky and happy to welcome Rebecca this evening. Also, please excuse it if you can hear the ice cream truck going down outside my house. Tonight's author will be in conversation. This is live performance, everybody. Tonight's author will be in conversation with Annie Leontes. Her debut novel, Let Me Explain You, was featured in the New York Times Book Review as Editor's Choice and was selected by the ABA as an Indies Introduced Debut and Indies Next Title. She is the co-editor of the anthology A Manner of Being, Writers on Their Mentors. Annie's other work has appeared in the New York Times Book Review, NPR, Gay Magazine, BOM, Guernica, McSweeney's, and elsewhere. The Glass, her interview series with women and genderqueer writers, is running at BOM, The Believer, and Electric Literature. And her memoir, Sex with a Brain Injury, will be published in January 2024. Annie is also a member of The Claw, a Philadelphia salon for women and genderqueer writers. Rebecca, Annie, thank you both so much for being here, and the screen is yours.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Rebecca. I'm so thrilled we get to do this together.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
What would you like to kick off by reading for a few minutes and then we'll jump in?
I'm going to read a little bit just for about 4 or 5 minutes. This is my book. I will be reading from it. And this is from a chapter that is looking back at the events that brought the protagonist to the lodge where she's working in the first place, and discussing a particular fascination / obsession she has. I had been to the Kodiak Archipelago before. The previous year, I had been sent to spend the summer with my marvelous aunt. My aunt, when she explained where she lived, would make her hand into a map of Alaska. You make a fist, and then stretch your index finger and thumb out. Oh, that's backwards. Here it is. Your index finger becomes the Aleutian chain, fingertip west, stretching into the Bering Sea. And your thumb becomes the Alaskan panhandle, thumb tip south, pointing towards Vancouver. Where she lived was just below the second knuckle of the index finger on the island of Kodiak. I was sent to my aunt's cabin because it was thought that Alaska would correct me. My parents thought I was wayward because my grades were poor, and even though I was a junior in high school, I still had no idea what I wanted to do with my life. I had no drive. But I hadn't really dabbled in delinquency. I had never gotten it quite right. I bought the wrong hoodie, etc. So I was being sent away from the yellow California summer for being dissolute when I had only committed the crime of being interested in the dissolute. I was focused almost wholly on the subject of sleaze. What was sleazy? I didn't quite know, but I studied everything for traces of it. Sleaze had something to do with sex, something to do with danger, but it also had something to do with other, more occluded aspects of adulthood. I couldn't define sleaze. I couldn't anticipate sleaze, but I could identify it. Places like dive bars exuded it, but it could also occur in sterile environments. Sometimes, even in Starbucks, there would be a man with a particular paunch that strained his shirt in a beguiling way, or a woman tottering in cork heels. Then even the cranberries and the scones would twinkle with sleaze. I knew sleaze had something to do with excess, and because of that, I wanted very, very much of it. I approached the subject with a taxonomist dedication. I made lists of sleazy things and things that other people thought were sleazy but weren't, like cold weather as opposed to hot weather was sleazy because the streets were empty and there was more privacy. Cleavage was sleazy, but breasts were not themselves necessarily sleazy. Big rigs were sleazy, but so were four-door sedans. I made these lists when I should have been studying. I failed French. I was lost in a complicated maze of my own fashioning, almost 17, still biting my nails down to nubbins as I catalog. The word sleaze doesn't come up often when you're teaching English as a foreign language. I've only had students ask for its definition a few times, usually because someone on some forum has called someone else a sleaze bag or said, take it sleazy. When asked directly, I've made the elaborate shrug that communicates that I am not a dictionary. The definition can be looked up. But that's not exactly true. When I see students Googling, finding pictures of wide lapels and 5 o'clock shadow, I have the sensation of a drawstring being yanked closed. That's not all sleaze is, but I can't fully explain about sleaze. I can't write on the whiteboard, fruit candy fed into female mouths and colored Christmas lights out of season are both sleazy. Sleaze can't exist without proximity to danger. People believe that Florida is the sleaziest state, but they are wrong. It is Alaska. Ta-da.
Woohoo, I love that passage. I actually was in my kitchen talking to my wife and reading from that same section and being like, I have not heard sleaze talked about like this, and I just loved it. And in fact, I just want to say, you know, to those of us in the room, I just devoured this book. It's so funny and perfectly dark, prickly, I think was the word we were using in our earlier convo, in all the right ways. And it's so evident why it would be a best book of summer. So I can't hype it enough. It's just fabulous. And you know, there's so much I want to talk about with you. You know, this is a book that conveys a sense of possibility, even as it's capturing this sense of being trapped. And it feels like, you know, a book that's on the edge of wilderness, right? Not just the Kodiak, but even boundaries of civilization and boundaries of the self. And we have, you know, we're in this perspective of young Mira, who we learn has failed out of high school and is consumed by this impossible, you know, this vision and this fantasy of an impossible future. And she's sent to Alaska first to be with her, I love that you call her the marvelous aunt. And in a very devastating chapter. That comes to an end. And then, of course, she goes back to Lavender Island, where we're told that nature is a bear at the end of the garden. So I wonder if you could start maybe by talking a little bit about Kodiak and Alaska as, you know, God's own country, which is a riff that is delivered again and again in the book, and how a place like this creates, you know, both on and off the page, this constant potential for danger.
I mean, just the facts are that, I mean, it's a tremendously dangerous place, right? I mean, there are these very exciting and bombastic possible dangers, which I thought in terms of setting was immediately exciting, right? There, you know, on the one hand, there are bears, and on the other hand, there's cold, tumultuous water. Volcanoes can go off at any second. It has the Pacific Rim possibility of earthquakes. It's a volatile place. It's a volatile place, and it's remote. And I think that's certainly a source of its own danger. And besides just wanting to have the thrill of writing a book set in a place where literally a bear can just come and end you at any time. I like how the danger of Alaska is very much wrapped into Alaskan mythology, like the larger Alaskan mythology. The state motto is the last frontier, right? It's there. The end of the line is part of the legend of Alaskan self. And I think all of that sort of immediately seemed like fertile ground for a novel. And it was a place that I had done seasonal work myself. I had worked in a cannery and commercial fishing and also in the hospitality industry, which ended up being for me the strangest job of all.
I can't wait to hear more about that. We're going to make that a cliffhanger. But I do want to first ask, are you as afraid of bears as I am? Because that alone is terrifying. And B, in talking about the threats in, you know, this volatile place, as you call it, like that's the landscape that extends to the, you know, the sort of this uncharted frontier, but it's also the people, as we start to learn in Seaplane, right? It's like that has extended to the people too.
I think to answer the first question about bears, yes, but I'm also sort of afraid of myself being kind of an idiot around bears, because of course I know logically.
No one ever remembers, do you run or do you play dead? No one remembers that.
I don't remember that, but also I'm kind of afraid that I've never encountered a baby bear in the wild. And I would like to think that I would be a reasonable adult and be afraid and be like, I know this is bad, but I'm also kind of terrified that I'd just be like, that's an adorable creature. It must be time to play with it. So in the same way that fear of heights has a lot to do with am I going to stand back from the edge myself? I think my fear of bears is, am I going to think somehow that I can reason or charm a bear into being my buddy? So let's just hope I never have to have that encounter. And in terms of volatile people, I think that a lot of that, the volatility of the people in the novel, has to do with the fact that in the tourism industry, there's such a compulsion you feel obliged to sort of embody the place that you are purveying. If you are running an Alaskan wilderness lodge, you have to sort of embody Alaska in a way. Like that's part of the tourist experience. You like become the place. And I think that that taking on the mantle of any place, whatever it is, you know, a nice tranquil meadow in the English countryside or a dangerous bear-filled wilderness, I think that's a very volatile to do that sort of shape-shifting, and selling in a tourism role. I think that adds to volatility.
Right. And per that excerpt you read, if Alaska embodies sleaze, right, then the people sort of take that on too, right? And maybe you could talk a little bit about it. When I hit that, and it is an obsession for Mira, which seems to be, sleaze seems to in part be about danger and unexpected juxtaposition or even oppositionals. Like we're told the young and the old, the manipulative and the innocent. Morphine isn't sleazy, but maybe coke is. Trains aren't sleazy, but the train in Japan, because it's fast, might be. And then Mira goes on to talk about how sleaze requires the domestic, which I really love. So maybe you talk a little bit like, where did that come from? Or what did that open up for you as you were writing that in her perspective, maybe even versus, you know, your own, if there's a distinction between how Mira conceives of sleaze and you do.
So I think the idea behind the obsession with sleaze started sort of as like a contrarian or sort of perverse impulse in me, because there was a point where I was reading a lot of Westerns, which is like, an interesting genre to sort of binge on, because you get aware, if you're binging any genre, you get aware of how sort of watertight all the tropes are. And one of the tropes is the sort of outsider young figure, the young man in Go West Young Man, who is on a sort of like quest of becoming, going into this, sort of saturated white American mythology of the Western and all of the like layers of problems that has. And his idea usually has something to do with like purity or idealism. He's going to go out and find like the real nature and be a lonely dude on a horse and sort of be like streamlined towards his own independence. And I was thinking, well, there's all this purity. There are all these like young dudes questing after purity. I want like a sort of messy young woman, and like where that would be interesting. And also like what runs in opposition to idealized purity? And sleaze was a concept I thought of. I sort of flirted with that idea of having a figure who's going to like a place steeped in this Western mythology, the last frontier, right? Who instead of angling towards like, I'm going to ride off into the sunset on my trusty steed, is like the thing that I want to find in this Western landscape is like the saloon, right? Is the sordid underbelly of it, is sort of paradoxically like the populated part of this vast underpopulated landscape. So that was where it started. And then it sort of built from there, in part because I just have a deep fondness for writing lists.
Well, one of our participants wants to know if it was as fun to read about sleaze as it was for us to listen.
Thank you. I love reading about sleaze. I like the inner theater kid in me comes out. And like, I think was actually like a driving force in writing a first person novel was the fact that you get to be a little Daniel Day-Lewis-y and sink into the strange psychology. And so I like reading things out in Mira's voice because she's fun.
She is fun. And I actually, you know, I want to turn to her a little bit. Before we do though, I'll just invite folks who are here. If you want to drop questions into that Q&A box, we'll pull some as we go. We can do them right at the end. Go ahead and just drop them when you're ready. But you called her a messy young woman. And I think that you're talking about in the best way, right? Like she's a full bodied person with these kind of conflicting impulses and this great drive. And she's, she's in this wild world opening up to her. And that's like the internal world. And it's also the external world, right? That's filled with sort of shadowy figures and men, most of whom do not behave well, but she's like sly. She's observant, this like young woman on a precipice. What was it like to write in that voice, right? This young person who has a lot, you know, you're both sort of in the immediate and also writing kind of from an aware perspective later in the future, but mostly grounded in her youth and in her kind of grappling with what's surrounding her and sometimes the cues she misreads and also the ones she reads really, really well. So what are you capturing with a voice like this?
One of the things that I wanted to do was sort of work, work intentionally with the messiness that you like, you very correctly identified as like, when I say that, I mean that as an absolute net positive, where having a young woman who's allowed to be, you know, in one way hurtling towards sort of her own destruction and making choices that make sense only in the context of her own brain, and only in the context of if you too are obsessed by a nebulous concept of sleaze and have decided to like almost monastically like dedicate your life towards that, except of course not monastically, because there's a lot of lust involved, so that's a bad choice, but like, yeah, single-minded obsession. I just wanted to have someone have the autonomy and the agency to fuck up, you know, like that was important. And I think that makes an interesting character for me. That makes an interesting, like, young character, especially when I think there's still pressure to make especially young women have a veneer of perfectionism. They have to have been right in the end all too often. Aspiring to messiness was part of the plan all along.
Good plan. Sense of like resisting goodness, you know, this like, yeah, the veneer of goodness or the expectation of goodness. But the thing is actually that she, you know, she's messy and young and complicated, but she's also subject to the advances and aggressions of men around her, right? A lot of which she's courting because she's in this place developmentally, and it's, you know, the dangers and the sleaze are exciting to her. But it's such a remote place, and there is this, it feels like slackness of rules and roles in the way we might, you know, the way we pretend to have in less wilderness, you know, sort of like the cities or whatever. And so like Stu, right, the proprietor, he clearly preys on young women who come through, and she has an encounter with her aunt's new husband that I found to be, for me, one of the most moving passages in the entire book. And I won't spoil it because I want people to just read it on their own. But it does feel like, you know, in some ways, the women are being subject and the men are kind of getting off pretty easy, right? And it feels like you're reflecting some things in this, you know, this microcosm of the larger world and dynamics. So do you want to speak to that at all?
Yeah, I mean, I think that what you were saying is true. And like that's one of the interesting things about moving all of the action in this book basically takes place on two small islands in a larger archipelago, and people act on small islands, you know, in the way that they do in the larger world, but there's just less buffer between people. Like when you're in the wilderness, when there aren't that many people around, intentions become clear in a way. I think that this is, I think that this has something to do with like the fantasy that people have of going away with a beloved to a remote island, right? That's a common fantasy where you're like, if only all of the noise of the world could fall away and it was us on a beach together, and just having that same impulse. What if the rest of the world fell away? What if it was a small amount of people in a small island? Was an interesting narrative stage. I think, I think that that's where it came from, was just in an interest in a compartmentalized world. And then lo and behold, it did reflect and behave according to the same rules as our more populated, fraught world.
You do the tertiary characters so well, most of whom end up being tourists. And I think, you know, you must have had fun doing that. So what was it like for you? What was exciting, or what did you want to, you know, put on the page about the tourists, particularly considering, you know, we walk into these remote places or these exotic worlds with a vision of ourselves in that place, or you know, the rest of the world fallen away, right? So what was that for you?
A lot of that has to do sort of more biographically than the rest of the book, because I am from California and I currently live in Germany. And I've lived in Germany for more than half a decade now. I'm married a German, I live there now. And every single time I come back to the US, there is a sense of being both an American returning home and then being in this way, like in the role of a European tourist. Since I'm like, especially when I come with my German husband, there's a feeling of like encountering America anew and having people treat me like I'm also a tourist, and have it, and that's such an interesting and alienating thing to happen, to be coming back to California and, you know, having lived my entire life in a distinctly not touristy part of California, and then being like, okay, we're gonna go to Big Sur, we're gonna go to San Francisco, and being treated as if I had never set foot in California. And I find that fascinating. So the opportunity to have all of these tourists come into this island and then see the way they're being treated and see like the, how the like legend of Alaska is being repeated ad nauseum to them. That was fun and interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting that you talk about being between places, because I imagine Mira is that kind of, you know, for her whole life. And I saw actually that you, I think it may have been Electric Literature, you posted a just kind of like a rundown of books that happen on islands. Do you have any recs that you want to share with us?
Oh, yeah, I do. I definitely do. In terms of tourism, I recently, you know, in thinking about islands and thinking about tourism, I read The Disaster Tourist for the first time. And speaking of prickly, it's just this pitch black, prickly, and also like often hilarious novel. And the premise is a woman is working for a tour company that's specializing in sort of like unholy dark tourism, and goes to this island nation, a fictional island nation that's plagued by sinkholes. And she's there to sort of suss it out and be like, are there enough sinkholes on this island to tempt the kind of clientele this dark tourism company I work for, will this appeal to them? And she's like, actually, it's not dangerous enough. And then she starts talking to people who own a resort, and they're like, well, what if we could manufacture more sinkholes? What then? And it's bleak. It's bleak and also deeply funny. That would be a big wreck.
Yeah, I love that. That sounds hysterical. I feel like, you know, your book and this book really speaks to like the dark mythos of the self. You know, we sort of fall away when we occupy those island spaces, right? Like, I mean, everything feels like a little bit in the shadow of Lord of the Flies. You put human beings on an island, and they just wear our most depraved selves. And you had an insight to that, as you know, as you said, someone who was in the industry. And I noticed that with your young people, right? The laborers in the book, you write about how they're, quote, in service of a paradigm of American wilderness, which I loved, right? Because there is a kind of criticism here about class, about economics, right? About exploitation. And that can be young people, it can be marginalized people. You know, so I'm curious about, you know, you talk about a wild place being used for show. And then, of course, the bodies, you know, even people like Chef who kind of have to conform to that. What was your experience like then working, you know, you said was your most memorable job or strangest job. What was it like for you?
Yeah, I mean, memorable and strange and sort of haunting because, thank you for pointing out the fact that the labor that people working there, working in especially seasonal tourism, that is, it's hard work, long hours. And especially when it's a place where you have to, part of the package is room and board. The room and board, when you're in a remote location, I found could be used as sort of license to make people work around the clock. And so people working around the clock and then having to perform the same happiness as the tourists and perform the same, like, this sense of like chipper discovery, like today we're going to look at something new that we've have you ever seen such beautiful wildflowers? Have you ever been this close to a whale? And performing newness and sort of like shiny novelty when your job is actually so full of repetition and every day is the same and pretty grueling. I thought that was, you know, in many ways weirder and stranger and much harder than doing something like working in a cannery where it's grueling physical labor, but you do not have to be sunny.
Yeah, that sunniness, right? I mean, it's hard not to think of like places like Disney, right? That are familiarly manufactured, but then you go to a resort like this, right? And it's part of the draw. Part of the draw is that this performance. So I really liked that in the young characters here. I did want to pull up a question. Tia asks, so you got your inspiration by living and working in Alaska. Are you similarly inspired by living and working in Berlin these days, aside from the fact that its mascot is the bear?
I think Berlin is fascinating and really interesting, but I think probably more important to me writing this book and it being about Alaska, more important than me being there and working there was me no longer being there and working there. And having that as a discrete part of my life that I now can look back on and have the sort of privilege of distance to understand more fully. It's funny thinking about the commonality of the bear, which I had never thought of before. Maybe I'm just drawn to places that have bears somehow, and maybe. But luckily, I mean, the nice thing is that all the bears in Berlin are like on a beer bottle, or there'll be like a cute plexiglass statue of a bear eating an ice cream cone. So my impulse to try to make friends with bears is not going to kill me in Berlin, thankfully.
Yeah, I've never been moved to make friends with a bear, but I have that lifelong terror of them. Okay, so.
I want to hear what your fear of bears is. Like, are you?
I used to be a civilian and have no knowledge of them whatsoever. And then I read this book called Surviving Survival, where this young couple were in Montana and they were brutally mauled by a bear. They both went on to live, but she was so haunted by this bear. If you want to be freaked out by bears, highly recommend. Very vivid, like dad nonfiction.
What is it? Surviving?
Called Surviving Survival.
Surviving Survival.
Yeah.
Okay. Were they camping or did the bear?
They were hiking and the bear had been eating some, like a goat it had caught or something, and they got too close without realizing. But of course she had this like instinct, like, I feel like we should turn back. And he's like, nah. And they just kept going. And then they were attacked. And yeah, it's a really, I was like, I don't know if I can even go to Montana. That for me is it, like, the New Jersey is as far into wilderness as I'm going, I think. But this book, so one of the things I want to talk to you about it is how you tell the story, right? Like, it feels a little bit like, I think somebody was calling it trickster fiction, where we're getting some insight, some knowledge, but there seems to be a kind of sleight of hand with this switchback structure where the information is revealed a little bit, you know, later. Is that about Alaska itself? Is that about Mira? Is it just kind of the way that you write? I love it. I thought it was like a great feature of the work.
I think... A, thank you. B, I hadn't thought about this. C, my answer, which I think this is my answer, is that things sort of build towards a final climax, right? Like classic arc. But I wanted a pervasive hauntedness. And I wanted there to be a sense that the smaller things that happen, the sort of smaller incidents, upsetting moments that pepper the novel were as much fertile ground for being haunted as any as any sort of like final climactic acts, which is just what I tend to think is can often be true, that like looking back at the things that bother you in memory or that bother me in memory, sometimes it will be like the worst things, and sometimes there will be like small details that in retrospect were part of a larger building towards that, but you didn't realize it at the time. So that switchback that you were talking about, I think, was in service of that.
Yeah, and there's, I mean, certainly realistic, a lot of inherent tension. And I think one of the invisible engines of the work that help evoke that danger, right, that risk that she leans into. You know, I'm just going to switch tracks a little bit, and then we'll go back to the Q&A. Your grandmother is the celebrated poet Muriel Rukeyser, and you recently wrote about her, how you resisted reading her for a long time, right? Like I think you shared that you were struggling with how she's moving fluidly from, you know, you to I, the second to the first person. But then you said you found ultimately a common resistance and resentment at the false assumption of being known by others, which I think ties in a little bit to that previous question. You know, what was that like? You know, what did you confront in yourself and on the page when you were met with your grandmother's work, right? Like, how do you think of that now?
I mean, I'm still grappling with that, honestly. And, you know, I'm still writing more, like writing a longer project about that. I resisted reading her for a couple of reasons. One, just sort of surface level, and I mentioned this, is that I look a lot like her. So this was something that happened growing up, that like a Rukeyser scholar would come to our house and would, you know, want to look through some papers or like chat with my dad about something. And then there would always be this like, oh, I have seen an apparition. You look exactly like her. And that would be, that's like adorable up to a point. And then especially once I was like, I really want to, the siren of
the New York wilderness.
Yeah. Once I decided to be a writer, I really didn't want to be seen as an echo. Just having physically been regarded as an echo, I didn't want that. And so I just wanted to insulate myself. And the process of becoming uninsulated and reading her work, there's that weird family thing. In part, the same thing where you're talking to a sibling and you're laughing about the same thing that no one else is ever laughing at. There's that certainly come up. But I think what you were talking about, the reluctance to be told by someone outside of you who you are, or to be defined. I think a lot of that had to do with growing up, and my dad would talk about how his experience growing up, one of the things that people would always say was, oh, you must want to be a poet. Like, this must be a thing that you must want. And so it was my own desire for autonomy, and sort of refracted through my dad's. But now I'm reading her, and it's fascinating, and yeah, and is becoming a book length thing. So
is that the work of nonfiction?
That's the pursuing? Work of nonfiction. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is it sort of like a memoir about her, your relationship to her, or is it kind of larger than that?
It's larger than that because I never met her. She died 5 years before I was born. So it's sort of negotiating that legacy, what that means, how she lived and how that those echoes are like affecting my family still today. And then talking to scholars and sort of trying to learn more about her as a person through through scholars delving into her poetry. So it's really interesting. But in terms of like messiness, it is also at that like very messy stage.
Yeah, I imagine. I mean, what an inheritance to sort of contend with, and you know, particularly because it seems like you really identify as a prose writer, but you know, you're also attentive to the line level, right? Which is like, you know, you can't, it's hard to get away from the poetry of the line, you know? Yeah. So I was very curious about, I do want to turn to, we've got a couple more in the Q&A. First, Tia says, this is deft and very funny. So I want to relay that to you.
And
to
oh, Tia.
Yeah. And then we've got Deborah curious about the title and what its relationship is to the narrative.
Yeah. Someone was like, is it a book about aviation? It is not a book about aviation. But there are a lot of seaplanes and there are a lot of seaplanes landing. And it has something to do with the last image of the book, which sort of stands in for, you know, a yearning and desire that drives the character through the novel. But also, I don't know if you've been on seaplanes, but I find when you're the sensation of landing in a seaplane and you're going down towards the water, there's this sort of screaming feeling of like, no, this is not what we do. We do not go down onto the water. And that plummeting feeling, I thought, has a lot to do with the same feeling you may have, I did feel in moments of silly youth doing misguided things and then sort of bolting awake at 3 a.m. and being like, oh, this trajectory may not be the best one. So all of that, and I like seaplanes. I think they're cool.
Yeah, it's like seaplanes, bears, or adolescence.
Yeah.
We've got Garby asking, well, saying rather, you talked a bit about, you talked about feeling a bit like being a tourist when you're back in the US as an artist. How does it feel being back here? Is this a golden age for American art in that it's born from a turbulent era? Or do you feel something oppressive in the air here?
I mean, I do feel something oppressive in the air here, but I don't, I think it's hard to know what a golden age is until you're well out of it. But I think that there's a lot of fertility in turbulence. But I also feel my first artistic impulse always upon returning here is just feeling like that step of like, I'm not quite in it. And like the first move I have to make is like a reestablishment of like, what's happening here? Let me fully like immerse myself in it. So maybe let me think about that for the next month as I'm traveling around in the US and maybe get back to you about this. But
it occurs to me, I mean, Berlin is not, you know, it's not apart from some of the same issues we're grappling with, right? Like white supremacy and questions of immigration and how we treat people who are moving across borders. You know, there, of course, the gun violence in America is its own distinct thing. Yeah. But, you know, I imagine you're seeing that. What is it like to be an American in that space?
There is a lot of that, and there is a feeling often a conversation I don't like to have in Berlin is people saying, well, you must be so, you must, things must, for you, things must be perfect here because, you know, of things like gun violence in America or the healthcare system in Germany, which certainly makes things easier. But it is fraught, and there are terrible issues, like you said, with white supremacy. And I don't know yet how I see that playing out artistically. I think that because we're in it, it's harder to tell. But I hope. I mean, I think there's a feeling that must be like widely shared that like I hope for art to be grappling with everything. That is a source of possible optimism. But I don't know what I have other than that hope.
Yeah, no, I'm thinking about, you know, all of the ways we used art to just get through like the pandemic. When we had nothing else, we did go to art, you know, when we, we get distracted, but there was, you know, I read War and Peace as part of the Public Space Book Club, right. Which was, yes. Right. So it was like, you know, and there was like, oh man, what was his name? That amazing DJ who was spinning every Saturday. Right. And there were, you know, people were, there was like the Prince concert that came out of the vault that you could watch for 3 days. I mean, you know, we came back to art. It was feeding us, you know, there's Station 11, right? Where like we come back to Shakespeare. So I do feel like, you know, I agree with you. Maybe it's not hope, but maybe stubborn human trait to go back to art and narrative. And anyway, I want to say again how wonderful this book is, and so readable, perfect for the summer, perfect edge, even as there's some buoyancy in it. I'll just ask a couple maybe fun process questions. What did you cut from the book?
Oh, yeah. I cut more backstory. There was more. So the time frame in the book is the protagonist is 17, the summer of being 17, goes to Alaska the first time. And then the summer she's 18, she gets a job on Lavender Island. And in an earlier draft, there were things that were happening in the year between the two trips. That then it just seemed like, you know, one of those great fiction epiphanies you have where you're like, I don't have to do all of this. I can just jump. And then I just cut it out of the Word document, and suddenly things made sense.
Well, maybe in a reverse exercise, if you were to relay to us like a quick CV of all the jobs Mira might have in her life, right? We know she works in industry here, and then she teaches abroad. What else do you think she would do?
Well, certainly she would work in as a baker. She would definitely work baking. I can see her driving a truck. Happily, like a lot of alone time. That's an important thing for this character. And in terms of depending on how interested in pursuing different modes of sleaze, I don't know, dealing blackjack in Vegas, that might be a good pathway. There's plenty of sleaze in in maybe Reno instead of Vegas. I don't know. But these are all possibilities.
I love that. She's either dealing blackjack or in a saloon somewhere.
Yeah, definitely.
That's perfect. Absolutely. Well, I think we've answered all of our attendees' questions. So I just want to say thank you so much for this amazing conversation. I really hope folks pick the book up. Where will you be next in case we want to see you live again?
I will next be in LA. I'm going to be reading at Skylight Books with Angela Flournoy on the 13th. And I think there's going to be a live stream, but yeah.
Excellent.
Going back to the West Coast. So
love it. Love it.
Thank you so much for,
pleasure.
And all of these awesome questions, both Annie and everyone. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone. Enjoy your night.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.